Good afternoon. The Committee on Transportation Policy and Finance will come to order. And Representative Whalen, do you approve the minutes or move the minutes of February 23rd?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'll move the minutes.
Representative Whalen moves the minutes of February 23rd. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay.
Yes.
Minutes are approved. And members, we'll hear three bills today. Then we will have our conclusion of the from the department and from the other day. And we will start with Representative Anderson. Welcome, Representative Anderson. Would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mark Anderson, I'd like to move House File 594 to be referred to the Committee on Taxes.
All right, Representative Anderson moves House File 594 be recommended to referred to Taxes. You have an amendment, Representative Anderson. You'd like to move that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I've got the DE1 amendment, and all the amendment basically does is it follows language that was passed in the Senate, which strikes the need for aircraft users or owners to report their tax refunds for the avgas that we'll be talking about today.
Members, any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor of the DE1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. That motion prevails. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I get to talk to about one of two of my favorite things, besides brewing, airplanes. Today, we're looking at the one thing that keeps the airplanes in the air, fuel. You go to most airports in the country, and you can find two basic fuels. One's called Jet A. The other one's called 100 low lead. 100 low lead is a fuel that's used in most single and some light twin aircraft. It works on just normally aspirated engines, cylinders. We won't be talking about the jet fuel at all today, but these two fuels, under current statute in Minnesota, are taxed at a nickel a gallon, and 100% of that goes into the aviation fund. The FAA has decided that they're going to start working on limiting this 100 low lead and coming up with another type of fuel for these same airplanes to use. And only about 5 and 10% of the ground-based operators at these airports even offer what we call MOGAS, which is just it's a high-grade premium. It has no ethanol. Thank you. And a lot of the airplane operators that are using 100 low lead can get a type certificate for their airplane to burn this MOGAS. Well, MOGAS is what we call it, is still taxed under today's statutes at 28.5%, and that goes to the transportation fund. And since the FAA is going to be starting to cut back on the 100 low lead, a lot of the operators are going to be moving over to this MOGAS, which means we need to keep the current tax and the gas that's being burned in these airplanes, moving that from the 28.5 cents going to the transportation fund to keep it into the aviation fund as they phase out this 100 low lead. Sales. In 2014 alone, there was over 2.7 million gallons of 100 low lead sold in Minnesota. And out of that, they say that an estimated 6 to 7% was this MOGAS, this high-grade premium. And so what we're trying to do today is just move this MOGAS from being taxed at the 28.5% to the moving it to a 5% or the nickel to the aviation fund. And it's and again, it's not a lot of users are using that, but more and more people will be using that as we get off of the 100 low lead. And I think that's basically all we have on that. Now, some people have asked me, well, if that's the case, wouldn't a lot of these aircraft owners be pumping in this MoGas into their cars? Because they're going to save 23 and a half cents per gallon? Well, I don't think so, Mr. Chairman, because the average MoGas that people are buying at the airports is $4 a gallon, so it's still cheaper to get it at the pump. Plus, the nozzle doesn't fit into the car, so that's really kind of a moot point. So in essence, all we're trying to do is just codify the nickel gas rate from the 100 low lead into the MoGas.
Great. Any questions from members? Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Anderson, how much is this taking away from the highway user tax limit? You know, is there, did I miss that? Is there a fiscal loan on this or something?
Representative Earhart, I believe Mr. Lee can handle that question.
Mr. Chair and Representative Earhart, unfortunately, at this time, the Department of Revenue does not prepare revenue notes for finance committees until the bill has a hearing in taxes. So we won't know the impact to the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund before the bill is in taxes.
Any other questions? Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, it's not going to have any impact from what we would read this, because the MoGas, as you say, was 100% air fuel before. Now that it's being converted to MoGas, the dollars that we're talking about are now new dollars that would be coming into the user, the highway user tax, that we really are indicating here, if I understand this right, Mr. Anderson, that need to stay with aviation like it has before. So there, prior to this bill, there would actually be an increase in dollars coming back to the highway user fund. This just says let's keep those revenues that would be generated for airplane fuel stay with airports, which is the way it was designed, rather than going to the highway user tax. Is that correct, Mr. Anderson? Representative Anderson?
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg, yes, that is correct.
Any other questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Right. Representative Anderson, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I renew my motion that House File 594 be referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Representative Anderson renews his motion at House File 594 as amended, recommended to pass and re-recommended to taxes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. The motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Is he doing another bill? Okay. Representative Garofalo is just across the way, so we're having him come down. At this point in time, I will move House File 182, recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Taxes, and I think we can have Mr. De La Forest. Would you like to? Would you like to come on down and speak to that? Well, we do have an author's amendment, too.
Yeah, that's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Then I think maybe we'll pause just a moment and see if he's here shortly. There we go.
Who are you?
Welcome to the committee, Representative Graffalo. Thank you for double duty. I did move the bill, but I understand you have an author's amendment as well.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, there's an A1 amendment to put the bill in the form that I would like.
All right. Chair will move the A1 amendment to get it in the form the author would like. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. That motion prevails. Representative Graffalo.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, just to be clear, this is being recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Taxes. Is that correct?
Correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House File 182 accomplishes two important public policy goals regarding the tax treatment of CNG, compressed natural gas. First of all, the bill addresses the anomalies currently between federal tax law as well as the tax rate itself here in the state of Minnesota. It aligns the energy content numbers of CNG to the federal IRS standards, eliminating the need for those who use compressed natural gas to convert that to both the federal as well as the state rates. Second, the tax rate on CNG is reduced to put it on a level playing field with existing traditional fuels. Currently, compressed natural gas is taxed as diesel equivalent, meaning that there is a penalty for using compressed natural gas over diesel. This despite the fact that all the data shows that compressed natural gas is actually a cleaner burning fuel to diesel. At a minimum, I believe the public policy of our state should not penalize those who use compressed natural gas or reward people for using diesel. So I want to acknowledge that this bill has broad bipartisan support. I believe it's also that the amendment today aligns this bill with the language drafted by the Department of Revenue and is contained in Governor Dayton's budget recommendations. With that, members, I ask for your support, and I'm happy to answer questions. I also have an expert testifier with me here, Mr. Chairman.
Fantastic.
And Mr. Chairman, for the record, Chris DeLaForest. I'm here representing Ace Solid Waste today, proudly headquartered in Representative Whalen's district. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm mindful of two things here today. One, you have the commissioner coming to testify, and two, I'm not aware of anybody who is going to testify against the bill today, so it's going to inform the length of my testimony. And in that regard, Mr. Doug Carnival has joined me today as well, and he represents the National Waste Haulers Association, which is our umbrella group, which is more than just the haulers I represent. So I defer to his comments, which I share. Ace certainly appreciates Representative Garofalo's authorship of this bill, and maybe after Mr. Carnival's testimony, I'd be happy to stand for any questions or comments that the committee might have, Mr. Chairman, if that's okay with you.
Just one moment, Representative Earhart.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. What happens to the 25 cents? Where does that go? Per gallon equivalent.
Right.
Where does the tax go on?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Earhart, these funds are in the Highway User Trust Fund.
All right, thank you.
To be used however the committee sees fit. I'm going to stay out of that debate for today.
Okay. Representative, or Mr. Carnival.
State
your name to the committee.
Doug Carnival, McGrante Carnival Law Firm, and I'm here today to testify on behalf of the Minnesota chapter of the National Waste and Recycling Association. The waste and recycling industry has more heavy-duty compressed natural gas trucks than any other industry in the United States except buses. Our industry has been a leader in the purchase of natural gas trucks and the installation of CNG fueling stations and is the fastest growing segment among heavy-duty trucks. Our members in Minnesota have 174 trucks and 6 fueling stations located in the metropolitan area. The hub-and-spoke nature of waste and recycling collection vehicles works well with trucks returning to their home base at night and being able to refuel before the next day. CNG trucks are expensive. A typical recycling truck costs $300,000, with CNG trucks about $30,000 more. A typical fueling station, depending on existing site retrofits, such as maintenance bays for trucks, can cost anywhere from $2 million to $4 million. Additional expenses are included with training mechanics and drivers so that they have the expertise to work on and drive these vehicles. Despite these expenses, these trucks are easier to maintain, are quieter, and cleaner. For example, greenhouse gas emissions are reduced by 21% over standard diesel engines, and if CNG gas is derived from landfill gas versus standard pipeline CNG, the greenhouse gas can be reduced by 90%. Yet the CNG tax rate is higher than the gasoline gallon equivalent and the diesel gallon equivalent. Our industry supports this legislation because it removes the CNG penalty and eliminates a market distortion that favors diesel. This legislation will provide a level playing field with regard to fuel taxation. This bill makes environmental sense, and we appreciate the bipartisan support to remove an impediment to that change and advocate the implementation of this renewable fuel. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Carnival. Mr. Cummings from the department.
Yet? Not since this morning.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I'm happy to be with you here today. Usually when I provide testimony, I'm providing it vague comments as a resource that tend to lead people to believe something, but today I can say with certainty that this bill as amended is a good bill. We would think that the committee should support it and move this along to tax committee.
Okay, that's good. That's right, we're done.
As it is part of the governor's budget. Mr. Chair, current Minnesota law provides that the British thermal unit BTU content for CNG at 1,000 BTUs. The IRS and industry standard is 900 BTUs per cubic foot. IRS and IFTA, International Fuel Tax Agreement, use a conversion factor of 126.67 cubic feet of CNG for every 1 gallon of gas. Current Minnesota law uses a conversion factor of 114.9 cubic feet of CNG for every gallon of gas. The consistency with the IRS and IFTA will allow taxpayers to not use two conversion factors. In addition, it will provide CNG taxpayers to be on a level playing field with other types of taxpayers. So with that, we support it. Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, there are other transportation tax provisions that are very good that you may want to look at as well, and we're happy to be a resource as well on those. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Earhart.
Mr. Cummings, is there any way you can equate electric uses by electric vehicles to a gasoline equivalent?
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am not an expert in that area. We can get back to you, but you know, this is always something that we're willing to work with the committee on if there's need to be more information.
Mr. Chairman, I think that it's only right that since we're fixing up one factor of powering these vehicles, that we fix another one that's not paying anything toward that, toward the needs of our roads.
Mr. Chair, I know part of what we do every year is we work on a policy and technical bill in order to, you know, basically fix up the tax code in order to make it as well as possible.
That's it.
So, and we identify items as they come up. So this was something that came up, and we thank Representative Garofalo for working with us and working with the industry on making this needed change.
Right. Mr. Cummings, one quick question. Does the governor's budget then, if he gets an increase in tax, or does this automatically go up as well then?
Within the bill, the transportation tax bill, there is modifications to other fuel types other than gasoline. So, and part of that is CNG.
So does that mean yes, this would increase, or no, this would not increase?
Well, as part of the bill, all of the other fuel types within, including CNG and others, would have a modification to their tax rate, just like gasoline would. So we would be wanting to make the energy content, the tax on the various types of energy content similar. So I hope that answers your question.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Cummings. Are there any other testifiers who would like to testify on this bill? Okay. Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your support and ask the committee to act favorably on it.
Thank you. The chair renews his motion to pass House File 182. Thank you. House File 182, as amended, be passed and referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you.
This breeze right through.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I anticipate this will be the third of three non-controversial bills, so we'll be moving right along. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 526 for possible inclusion, be laid over for possible inclusion.
Representative McNamara moves House File 526 to be laid over for possible inclusion at a later date. Representative McNamara, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill, many of you may remember it passed on, I believe it was... Was it Representative Hornstein, your bill, or was it on Representative Earhart's bill? On one of the bills last year, it was either, I think it was one of those bills anyway. And it what it does is it allows the smallest of the portable toilet facilities, trucks that service those facilities, to operate on spring weight restriction roads with a similar exemption that all of the garbage trucks get. But it would only be I was going to bring the props because the props were so good 2 days ago in committee, but I couldn't find one of the great big garbage truck with four axles that we currently allow to run on the roads and my little one-ton porta-potty truck. But I'll get those at a later date, Mr. Chair, because Representative Hoseman and I, for our grandkids, like to look at toys. So, Mr. Chair, to speed things along, because I know you want to spend the most time with the commissioner, this just allows the smallest trucks. I think you'll hear from all the people that don't like exemptions that they don't like this. But the seriousness of the matter is that sometimes porta-potties in our parks or on a construction job will sit on the project for a whole month because the provider can't come and service them. And so you've got a dilemma. The provider can break the law and service the porta-potty or remove the porta-potty from the site, which then you can use your own imagination what happens. Or we could pass a sensible exemption that allows only the smallest trucks. Yes. This won't allow the bigger trucks. It's just the smallest trucks. And if some of them don't have this small of a truck, maybe they'll want to think about buying one. And so that's the bill. Mr. Chair, I believe, and I'm not positive, but there may be a testifier or two in favor of the bill, and if I'm not mistaken, you'll probably have an array of folks to come down and say the world's going to end if this bill passes. Not literally, but they're going to be opposed to it.
Thank you, Representative McNamara.
Yeah, yeah.
Ms. Breidich. Okay. And Mr. Sulem, did you want to join?
Yeah, we're going to do it.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the committee record.
Thank you. My name is Abby Breidich. I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties. And we do have some concerns with this bill, many of which we've shared with Representative McNamara. I think where, you know, I have this wonderful description about why we have spring thaw restrictions and the science behind the road stuff. I kind of wanted to tell you because I had to learn it, so I think you should learn it, but I'll pass on that. I think where our objection lies is that in the fact that, you know, these few restrictions that we, or exemptions that we do have for the thaw weights, we've identified many compelling reasons why they can't adhere to them. For example, for the garbage truck haulers, we understand that their trucks are overweight when they are empty. So they couldn't haul any garbage away if they adhered to the limits. And for example, the milk trucks, for sanitary reasons, they can't deliver partial loads. We worked with one of the industry representatives on this bill last year, and it was not described to us at that time that the trucks were too heavy when they were empty. It was described that it was not economical or practical for them to take partial loads. And we interpreted that to mean that it was inconvenient to take multiple trips. You know, these roads that these folks can be driving on, you know, state roads are built to standards that can withstand these issues with the spring thaw, but local roads are not. And they can do a pretty serious amount of damage when the roads are that vulnerable. So we're not saying that sanitation haulers and certainly these kinds of businesses aren't important. None of us want to use our imaginations to think about, you know, what this might look like, but we're still left unclear with why, what the compelling reason is for this group to have an exemption. And if it is just inconvenience, I mean, at the end of the day, we may as well not have the restrictions, because, I mean, they are inconvenient for some people, and we acknowledge that there might be some increased cost to businesses during this very narrow window, but compared with the amount of damage they can do to some of our really vulnerable roads, we don't see a compelling interest for them to have an exemption. Unless there's some information that's missing from that equation, that's where our concerns lay, and I think Sulem had some.
Thank you. Mr. Sulem.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ken Sulem, General Counsel and Director of Governmental Relations for the Township Association. And our association shares the concerns that Ms. Breidich has outlined. There was no oversight in leaving certain vehicles out, including these trucks. Those who have exemptions have, in fact, come to us, worked with us, explained the very specific concerns, the very specific issues that led to the exemptions. Some of them went on over our objections. I mean, there's no question about that, they may not have made the case to our satisfaction, but they still went on because they met your concerns. A year ago, Representative McNamara and I discussed this bill in terms of when there would be an actual health threat, when you might have raw sewage out on land, and that's not anything we support. Obviously, we've worked with the governors in the past on executive orders that have granted temporary exemptions to deal with that type of thing when we've had frozen septics. Something comparable could work in this situation. Yes, we know that these are very important services. Yes, they're out on the construction sites and the gravel roads, which largely tend to be ours, at least at the start. But there's also the ability to do some planning. You know what your construction schedule is. You know how many people are there. There's ways to plan around and have the porta potty serviced, try to minimize the need for being on the roads during these couple of weeks of very vulnerable status. So we just simply echo the concern that the more exemptions we grant, they swallow up the rule, and until there's funding to truly build the 10-ton system I think we all talk about, we simply cannot support one more exemption that's not directed towards an actual public health immediate safety threat.
So, McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had asked these folks to meet with the industry and discuss this issue, and unfortunately it looks like they haven't done that yet, so I'm going to ask them to do that before the bill comes back. Because the reality, unlike the garbage and the milk business, these trucks basically are full all the time. Thank goodness they come in with clean water and they take away the dirty water. So the only gain in their load, you can use your own imagination to what it is. So basically, these trucks have the same weight, empty or full, and they need this exemption more than the folks that come in empty and fill up and get your garbage or fill up and get your other exemptions that we currently have. These folks, their only possibility is to, is even harder for the other trucks, they have to be literally underweight when they're empty and then go literally to maybe one porta potty and then go to dump and go back again if they're able to even meet it like that. So the practical purpose is, if you were going to have an exemption, this would be the one that you would want to have it for. And so, Mr. Chair, I guess I would ask the testifiers to meet with the industry and understand the challenge here. And this is only for the smallest of the trucks. Again, it's not for the big trucks that they already exempt on these local roads that are really pounding the roads. These are a little one-ton truck that has a need to serve, and I think it's a good common-sense bill, and I at least would like to get an understanding of the facts so that we're presenting a good understanding.
Representative Uglem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question of Representative McNamara. You know, in this cold weather and everything, these guys are not, you know, hauling water. They'll be hauling water in a mix of methanol, alcohol, or maybe even propylene glycol, so the effluent doesn't freeze. Have there been any calculations on that? Because alcohol, methanol, obviously weighs a lot less than water, so maybe they're not hauling as much as we think. Have there been any calculations on that?
So, McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Uglem. The exemption's only for during the spring weight restrictions,
right,
which generally go on after they're able to use 100% water. So generally speaking, the weight restrictions won't go on until the beginning of April. And so I think for most practical purposes, they're
it's
using a mixture of all water. And
okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Sulem.
I've been in the chair too long, apparently. I just want to clarify one quick issue, and by all means, we're more than happy to meet with Representative McNamara. We've had very good conversations. We actually do support a number of his bills this session. With the weight limits, it's just a little trickier, but Ms. Breidich did, at the start of her testimony, indicate that she had met with the individual company that started this effort a year ago. I was not available for that meeting, but by all means, we're happy to meet and have those conversations.
Thank you very much. Thank you for being with the committee. We have Ms. Pauling.
Yes or no?
I don't see anyone coming down yet. We'll move on to Kelly or Kim Tom. She just stood up. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Welcome. Please state your name for the committee record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Mary Adam, and I work with on-site sanitation, on-site companies.
Okay.
We are a portable restroom company, and we do use the smallest of trucks, and everything that was spoken about relates to our industry relates to what we do. When people in our industry found out where I was coming today, several of them, three or four more of them, have sent me more letters. I got them just a few hours before I came here, so I didn't get passed along. Yes, this has been an issue. This has been an issue for a long time. I've been in this industry for over 22 years. We do go in sometimes to areas with restrictions, with as light as a truck as we can get. But as Senator McNamara said, Representative McNamara stated, our trucks are never really empty. We're bringing things and taking things. It is after April. We don't have additives in there. It is just basically water. Waste can add to the weight. And I won't lie, sometimes we sneak into restricted areas and get out of there quickly. You have to, sanitation is the first thing that will cause a problem if you don't keep it clean, if you don't keep it serviced, the waste removed. And like he said, sometimes it can go a month. Some of these units can't hold the waste of a month, so we do have to get in there. I'm going to pass it off to another one of our industry leaders.
Hi, my name is Kelly Thomas. I'm the owner of Air Fresh Industries. We are based out of Stillwater, Minnesota, and we are a portable restroom rental company. And I am here today in support of the portable restroom industry and this file number 526, and we are looking to include the portable restroom service trucks in the same weight restriction exemption as the solid waste and recycling vehicles. We have the similar routes as garbage vehicles, and we service the city's parks, schools, construction sites, residential homes, and special events. Our company in particular also services the Department of Army National Guard for soldier training in both here in Arden Hills and at Camp Ripley in Little Falls, Minnesota. Our industry provides service to maintain the health and well-being of our communities that we serve. Our company is relatively small. We only have a few service trucks, and this minor change in the statute would have a large impact on our business and other small businesses, owners in the portable restroom industry across the state. We have F-550 trucks with a 600-gallon waste tank gun bag. As this year's past president of the Association of Women Contractors, I'm also a voice for the construction industry, and portable restrooms play a very large role in that. So I am requesting to include portable restroom service trucks to be a part of that same weight restriction exemption as the solid waste and recycling vehicles. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Jeff Springer. I'm with On-Site Sanitation. I am the branch manager for Rochester. I've been in the industry for 20-plus years myself. I do support House File 526. It was mentioned it was an inconvenience earlier that we could work around. It would be incredibly difficult if, take for instance, right now I have a job site that has 30 units on it. That means there's 500 guys working on a particular job site. How do we manage that? Do we go back to that site five times, six times in a day to be able to service that particular site? I do believe it's more than just an inconvenience for our industry, and that's basically all I have to say about it.
Thank you. For me, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So last year I did sign on to the McNamara Amendment on the floor, and it actually was for the new people. This was the House position going into conference committee, but the Senate not agree with us. I tend to oppose these things, but you know, one of the reasons I didn't have quite the concerns are that I didn't imagine that the actual number of trucks was that high. Could you confirm that? I mean, are we talking about just dozens and dozens of trucks traversing the state region per day, or what sort of numbers are we talking about here?
In the state itself?
Or the state, or the region, or,
Ms. Adam? Or Mr. Springer?
I could say On-Site Sanitation is one of the largest haulers, portable restroom servicing companies in the state. We have in the St. Paul office, Mary, 25 trucks?
We have 25 trucks with that pull route and 8 that do P&D on an average during the day. One day in the metro location itself, we're going to have 30 to 32 trucks on the road. In the Rochester branch, we have 5 to 6 trucks on the road.
Okay, so, Mr. Chair, it does sound like a relatively small, compared to some other
stuff. It's just the area, and we connect.
Okay, good. Well, that was one of the reasons I was okay with it. The other one, really, is I imagined what the opponent's literature would look like if I opposed this bill. So, anyway, but I hope we can maintain the House position on this.
Position
that we had last year.
That's better.
Yeah.
Representative Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, I thought you were talking about trucks that haul individual. I'm calling them porta potties, but that's are you talking about that, or are you talking about the tankers that haul effluent?
Ms. Adam.
It's kind of a double, okay? What we have are 550 trucks. We have a 600 capacity waste tank. There's a gate on the back of that truck that can haul 2 units. Huh. These trucks are what you call a straight truck. We can also pull a trailer, depending on the size and length of the trailer, weight and length of the trailer behind that truck, to haul or deliver more restroom. But each truck is equipped with a gate that will take 2. And that's what we do in some road constricted areas, is bring them in 2 at a time rather than a dozen or 16.
Well, Senator, we've got a limitation on weight in here, I think, but what are these things on average? What do they weigh when you got them loaded? That's the question.
Mr. Springer.
The trucks that we run are the F-550s. They are, the GVW of the truck is 18,000 pounds total. That's both axles. So we're well below the 14,000 the 14,000 pound restriction.
Loaded.
Okay. Any other questions, members? Are there any other testifiers in the audience who'd like to testify on this bill? So, McNamara, any other comments?
No, Mr. Chair, I look forward to the discussion and the possibility that we could find a solution here. And the one thing I will say, I'm going to visit with the proponents to better understand exactly what they need for this size truck to work, because I didn't realize they may not even need the full capacity that we're asking for here based on the weight of those trucks. So I want to be sure I understand just what we are talking about here. I just want them currently, unfortunately, as the testifier said, they're kind of in a tough situation, either to service and keep a healthy situation, they literally have to break the law or get this exemption. So I'm just hoping we can find a common sense solution here. So thank you for the time, and I know you have other things going on. So at this point, Mr. Chair, I guess I'd like the bill laid over for possible inclusion.
Great. Thank you, Representative McNamara. And the chair will lay over House File 526 for possible inclusion in a bill at a later date. Thank you. Now, members, we will have Commissioner Zelli down the department and continue with the overview. Welcome back, Commissioner Zelli.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members.
But what we'd allow you to do today is get through the rest of your presentation, and hopefully we can do that in 15 or 20 minutes, and then allow for plenty of time for questions. And does that sound okay?
That sounds great.
Great, thank you.
Well, as you know, we left off actually at a good point a couple of weeks ago. Thank you for inviting me back. I will try to be crisp and not linger too much on any one slide. But we actually broke in a good spot because I had described kind of the next 10-year plan for the governor's proposal. But this is now really much more specific about the biennium. And I'm joined this time with our Deputy Commissioner, Chief Financial Officer, Chief Operating Officer, Tracy Hatch, who, skipping to the back of the presentation, you'll notice any questions, Tracy Hatch. I'll also be happy to answer questions, but I think the Deputy Commissioner can join me if there's any details you want to get the right answer. I will kind of just talk through a lot of different items. This is a summary page in your presentation, and as you can see, although it says next 10 for transportation, that's really the bulk of the funds that are on top of the base funding. I will just mention that roughly $700 million, the bulk of that is coming from the new revenues that were outlined previously, but $168 million is from the projected fund balance. And of that $699, most is going toward the state road construction budget. There's $49 million of that fund that is going toward the ongoing increased operating costs, which compose of everything from salt increases to actually some operating compensation costs, not 3%, it's the 1.8% increased in compensation. It's consistent, I think, with other agencies. I'll get into these other items as we get into it, but I wanted to just give you this quick overview. Just item by item, I'll start by talking about the rail grade crossing improvements and fees. This is the annual assessment. It's quite apart from the trunk highway fund. Which, of course, is those funds are not eligible to be spent on anything other than trunk highways. So this is actually a fund that is being proposed by the governor, where we believe we have legal authority as a state to impose a safety impact fee. The safety risks associated with freight rail goes well beyond just inconveniences to motorists. It's inconveniences and safety to entire communities. So this is actually tied to our rail grade crossing study that has identified approximately $325 million over the next 10 years of grade separations. We see that as a real need, and those who have been following your Twitter accounts or mail will know that we actually had a derailment this morning in St. Louis County. Nothing too dangerous, although three of the 13 cars that derailed did have hazardous materials. There have been no injuries, no casualties, and we don't think there's anything at risk. But it does seem to, almost on a daily basis, give some examples that we actually have risk associated with our robust rail industry, and we have to take it seriously. Likely that this $32 million a year that would be charged to the Class 1 railroads will meet with some resistance from those companies. They know about it, and as they said, it's unprecedented, but we think we have legal authority, and they may likely would oppose it, but we think it's worth and we think we have both the law and the public sentiment on the side to do something significant. Again, this is a 10-year outlook, and it would identify all the highly prioritized rail crossings that we know of today. This federal funding authority relates to federal funds that we actually is not new funds. It's funds that we know are coming from the Federal Highway Administration. This is roughly $47 million in fiscal year 16, $50 million in fiscal year 17. We asked for this to be added to the base funding because we have to seek actual appropriations, as you know, even though it's federal funds. The reason that we've had these adjustments is because in MAP 21, there's a they redid the formulas and created a higher priority for the interstates and our national highway, high-priority roadways. We have worked with local governments to ensure that they have not been adversely impacted over the past few years, but now with increased funding that came out of MAP 21, this will not, we think, as we understand it, adversely impact local governments in the long run, but it does give us now the base funding for what federal funds we know are coming into MnDOT. So it is part of our planning. It's not really new revenue other than what we've expected, but we do need to have a technical appropriation to access the funds. So I'll get into our airport appropriations. There's a couple of slides. The as you remember, during the last administration, there was a $15 million that was borrowed from the airport aviation fund, and that was paid back in its entirety. So we've actually were able to issue as much as $4 million in grants at the last biennium, and we see the need and are really asking for the appropriation to give $5.5 million in each year to help construct pavement quality, safety areas, other improvements that we see in the 135 airports around Minnesota. This, as you know, is a self-generating fund, so it comes with a full support, I believe, with the aviation community. And after kind of looking carefully throughout the budgets, we recognize both the need and then this available capital should be available for to be deployed. Part of the airport's appropriation has traditionally been a match toward federal funds, and local communities had been in the past giving up to 10% of the match toward these grants. We have found that given the scarcity of local funding, we have on a pilot basis, no pun intended, to have a 95-5 split, 90% federal, 5% local, 5% state. That has worked really well. We are asking for the authority to have flexibility as to what that funding match would be, given the resources of our $11 million that we now have access to, that we would have some flexibility with the with the proper discretion and analysis that we could actually raise the state match so to get projects going and projects in the ground. We think it not only would benefit the airports, local communities, but it would put this money to work faster, and we definitely see the need around the state. The Deputy Commissioner will interrupt me if I'm missing anything. That's so far. Okay. You perhaps all read and heard about our request for two state planes replacements. The fact that this says newer is not is subtle, but it is not. It is intentional. These are not brand new. These would likely be, I would say, gently used, but certainly a lot in better condition than the current aircraft, which is, I'm now looking closer at 33 and 21 years, are getting to be beyond their useful life. I talk a lot about useful life of bridges and roads. Well, vehicles have them too. And I think that they are safe, but the real issue has been the increased cost of maintenance. One plane in particular, actually it's the 21-year-old King airplane, is reaching its useful life of engines, which is the biggest cost of refurbishment, and before we were putting really good money, actually considerable amount of funding, into an aircraft which aren't now worth that much. We've had an outside analysis with a consultant to actually do a very comprehensive study, which we are happy to share with you, that actually recommends that we make this capital investment. If we are actually introducing an idea that I think is valid in other states, and taking more of a business perspective, is we should have a sinking fund or recognize depreciation in equipment like aircraft. So it is our intention to develop a new model for cost reimbursement when these planes are used by state agencies, that not just the cost of maintenance and operating costs, that we include an allocation for the capital cost of an airplane, and so a truly allocated cost be charged when these planes are used, and thereby developing a sinking fund so that we don't need to kind of go and have these larger one-time capital investments that it would be, in a sense, self-funding over time, or say close to it. The concept should be more pay-as-you-go as opposed to every 10, 20 years coming back and having a larger investment. But the lines are crossing in terms of both the maintenance cost, and then of course safety, I know, has been a concern of the governor, and that's why he has been promoting this this year. The Civil Air Patrol is a very successful part of our aviation program. This is maybe a minor change, but it's increasing the annual allocation by $15,000. That hasn't had an increase in some time. This is largely volunteers, but it does require some funding to kind of keep the program going. When we say that it has a net zero change to the aviation fund, that is coming from our own efficiencies within that office. We thought that idea of gaining efficiencies, how we do our practices, and applying those funds to this program is in keeping with our overall agency philosophy, and so we're really not asking for more additional appropriations, just a change in how we categorize some of the funding to help support this program. Again, in the interest of efficiency and business practice, we had been charged by the previous legislature to study all the land and right-of-way that MnDOT owns around the state but is not currently deployed in any practical trunk highway use. And after many conversations with the land office, it's clear that they are really not organized to be true asset managers. We are very good at purchasing right-of-way and negotiating that, but to actually manage it and to sell right-of-way and to lease right-of-way to maximize those assets, not just for the trunk highway use, but those that we get incidentally, should really be part of our program. The the structural challenge has been that our current staffing is really focused on their work to purchase property. So if what we're asking for is the authority to retain the funds when we sell property, and then have from those funds, use it to have the capacity both for some internal positions. We've started this as a pilot project, three or four people to actually actively manage those assets, and then be able to both sell property, lease property, and both generate the value from selling underutilized land, houses, buildings, but also be able to return some of those land into the tax rolls that helps local communities. Sometimes there's economic development opportunities, others that I'm aware of that could really have kind of great use for local communities, but they kind of get tied up in our own bureaucracy, I'd say, in a lovingly way. I think also we found we were finding opportunities to lease land for solar arrays, other uses that I think actually fit our mission, but also would actually generate revenue for the department. So we think that's a valuable process to be pursued. We have occasional environmental costs that are not part of any project. If there's an environmental cleanup or issue associated with a particular repavement or new highway project, of course the environmental work can be built into that that budget. But sometimes we're finding identified areas where we need to kind of do some cleanup, and it doesn't fit anywhere within the MnDOT budget. So what happens is we actually have to take it away from operations, and it hurts other kind of maintenance. We're asking for a $1 million appropriation for the use for just those contaminated soil projects that happen on our on MnDOT property. Also, in the context of efficiencies, we're roughly 70% of the parcels that are purchased for roadways are under $25,000. There's actually quite a bit of very small parcels. They're not controversial, but we're still required to do a full appraisal, and this appraisal waiver would give the agency the option of not having to do the full appraisal, to have an agreement with landowners, knowing that the landowners always have the right to ask for and receive a full appraisal if they'd like. We think that this will not only make it less expensive, but it really would save a lot of time. And when we're dealing with a landowner and they're willing sellers, we can actually get the cash to those landowners faster and actually move projects along much more efficiently. So there's a savings of dollars, but it's as much a savings of time and staff effort to streamline the agency.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rundbeck. We're going to pass on the questions till the end there. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Utility relocation, this is a longstanding statute which is not consistent for interstates like it is the rest of our trunk highway system and local roads, where the cost of relocation of utilities is borne by the agency in the case of interstates and not by the utilities. So this provision would be that the utilities would be responsible for the cost of relocation. For anything new, all those that are existing permits would be grandfathered in, but going forward, for any new permits, there would be a clear understanding that when the roadway was changed, that the utilities would bear that cost. That's very standard in most states. It's standard throughout the state of Minnesota, but it has become a very expensive and, we think, inconsistent cost for the agency in some projects. The snow and ice contingency is a new concept, it's not a new idea, but it is for our agency for the one factor which is most unpredictable for us and our operations, which is how much snow and ice cost do we have in any one year. So we all remember last year was really through the roof. This year we're slightly under budget. But when I first came into the agency 2 years ago and I asked the simple question of we're spending so much on snow and ice, what happens in the summer? And the quick answer is we just repair less guardrail, we repair less signage, we're not doing some of the ditch maintenance, and of course that accumulates more deferred maintenance, which makes it even more expensive later on. And I think last year, even though we had an appropriation late in the year, a lot of our operations for spring maintenance is held back because we're not sure how much money is in the bank. This is not a complicated idea that when the agency costs for snow and ice exceed 110% of our annual budget for snow and ice, which is really based upon the last 10 years, that we would be able to access the either reserve or unappropriated portions of the trunk highway fund that has not been appropriated. And by having that confidence, we'll be able to plan for spring and summer maintenance, all the work that has to be done, which we think is far more efficient. And even in the past, even this year, even though it looks like we'll be under budget, there still is the reluctance to actually start working on some of those potholes and ongoing maintenance work. Because there just isn't known, winter's not over, we could be hit hard, and we know what's happening in other parts of the country, so there's a lot of apprehension. And the next slide, you'll see how much it bounces around. I think on average, hopefully it will even out, maybe there'll be slight increases given the weather patterns, but it is really the unexpected extremes that hurts our operations. And I think this is I think this actually will translate to a more effective operations and actually cost savings if we just have it more of a planned kind of approach. This relates to an appropriation from 2012. We're asking to extend the expiration date for some work being done on Jay Cook State Park. This is a trunk highway that I don't know quite why it's a state trunk highway, but it goes through a beautiful park in Jay Cook. We actually did a lot of outreach and surveys as to how the citizens of St. Louis County and others wanted to treat it, and they really want that rebuilt, and we're going to do that. As much as I tried to give it to DNR, and I even offered to rename it Landauer Drive, and that didn't seem to interest them, so we're going to rebuild it, and we're going to get it done this year. Much of it has been done from the flood, but we're going to actually finish its work in this summer. But we do need to extend the appropriation authority to that. The money has already been granted. Now, just a couple of technical items, software sales and licensing revenue that we've developed much with our kind of GPS and other contracting work that we've developed within MnDOT, and we're able to actually recover costs from some of that development through sharing that licensing agreements with other states primarily. Or other jurisdictions, but we'd like to be able to have those sales and those fees come back to MnDOT, because it really is cost recovery rather than actually. We're not in the software business. This is just about how we can able to manage some of the work that we've been doing in conjunction with MnDOT. Tort claim, something we've actually worked on with MMB. We have a kind of a fund with MMB where they handle our tort claims. But both that agency and MnDOT think it would be far more efficient if we just handle it ourselves. The fund does come from MnDOT anyway, so it's not a question of the money. It's a question of how do we administer some of these smaller claims directly. And actually will cover so we don't duplicate some of the legal oversight that we've currently been doing. Now it's kind of looked at by two agencies. We can actually do it with one more efficiently. And the last item is the aeronautics network appropriation transfer. This is really a kind of shifting from one line item to another in our agency management budget activity to keep the aeronautics budget more accurate to what its real intended purpose is. So, any questions, Tracy Hatch? Anyway, questions, both of us are available, and I know I went through that really quickly, so I'm happy to go into any depth on any of those items or other items that you'd like.
Thank you, Commissioner Zelli. We appreciate that. Members, before we do go to questions, I'm going to ask our fiscal staff, Mr. Lee, to walk through some of maybe the higher percentage change items and dollars so that we can put some figures on that. Mr. Lee?
Mr. Chair and members, if you look in your packet, you'll see a sheet with sets of columns that show tracking. What the sheet shows is both the base appropriation for the various programs within MnDOT and additional change items in bold and italicized. And on the far right-hand column is a percentage change for the biennium, not just for the individual year, for the change within the fund. So, for example, on page one, you will see the Aeronautics Aviation Support and Base program, and you see a one-time increase for the state plane purchase, and then ongoing base increases. The one on line 19 is the shift in aeronautics, and the one on line 20 is the increase of 22.7% over the biennium out of the Trunk Highway Fund for aviation support services. Going down a few of the other larger items, in transit, the general fund increase of $10 million over the biennium, but that $10 million, or then in the base appropriation for fiscal 18 and 19 becomes $10 million a year in increase. That's about a 29% increase in the fiscal 16-17 biennium. And then moving on to the next page, you'd see a change item for freight. And then getting into state roads, the operations and maintenance change item, again, this is part of the next 10 item, larger item, is about $51 million for the biennium, or a 9.6% increase in that program. Going on to the next page, the change items for program planning and delivery, the overall next 10 change item, which is about a 26% increase for the biennium. And I should note, this is change for the base versus the governor's recs, not the previous biennium to the governor's rec, but the base budget to what the governor would recommend. And then moving down, you can see the SRC appropriation increase on line 78 and the federal fund spending on line 79. And the increased debt service to cover the new bonding, that's about an 8.8% increase on line 88. And moving on to page 4, you can see the next 10 increase on line 95 for electronic communications. And then on local roads, there's a few items that I should note. So with the increase in the creation of the gross receipts tax, there would be more money that flows through the constitutional distribution formula. So in addition to Trunk Highway getting more money, the CASA and MSAS formulas would also get money, and this is what appropriates that. So on line 110, there's the CASA increase, and then on line 120 is the MSAS increase. I will note one item in general fund spending on line 111, $2.5 million a year for bike and pedestrian grants. This is in addition to the already existing appropriation of $500,000 a year for safe routes to school, and the only difference is that is in the multimodal area, and this is in the local roads area. Finally, on the last page, page 5, you can see some of the other change items. The shift to aeronautics on line 133, and the increase in Next 10 for agency management on line 134, and then the tort claims shift on 135. And finally, on the 144 is the increase from Next 10 for buildings, and that's a 6.8% increase for the biennium. And one other thing I should note is this doesn't necessarily cover all of the governor's change items. Many of the change items are wider language within an appropriation. And so what that means is what this sheet shows is you have just the appropriations that we're giving to a specific project within MnDOT, whereas riders are up to X amount can be spent within an appropriation. So.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Representative Duskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a pile of questions, but I'll just start with maybe one and let others get around, Mr. Chair, if that makes
sense. That would
be
great.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Commissioner, and thank you, Assistant or Deputy Commissioner?
Deputy
Commissioner. I got to get the terminology right. Thank you. I was reading, Commissioner, in a Pioneer Press article from February 16th. They were talking about, well, I want to read the quote to you, or the, I don't know if it's a quote, but it's a statement in the article. And they said, MnDOT doesn't have a centralized database of road quality around the state. In fact, though the agency knows where each road in the state is, it doesn't even know for sure which roads are paved and which are dirt or gravel. Is that true?
Mr. Zelli.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Drakowski. I didn't remember. I don't remember reading that article. We do know, I assure you, which roads are paved and which are gravel. However, you know, they may be referring to all roads in Minnesota, 144,000 miles of roads. The state system is roughly 12,000. We have very detailed analysis of those 12,000, which accommodate more than 50% of the traffic. We do not have the inventory and the knowledge of local roads and private roads and county roads. So although we have a really robust state aid program, but our database and our inventory and understanding of local roads is not something that's in the province of MnDOT. So that
could explain it.
That may be well what they're describing.
And Mr. Chair, just to follow up quick.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Commissioner, the $6 billion of additional spending that this interest group that put this together over the last several years, comprised of road builders and unions and county engineers and others, does that include just those roads that those state roads that you talked about that you know every inch of, or does it also include the local roads, which you may not know if they're paved or not?
Well, the
Mr. Zelli.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair and Representative Rakowski, the governor's proposal really that $6 million of the state system. So it was really following up on the Transportation Finance Advisory Committee, which you're aware of was the kind of the group that spent over a year studying all roads in the system. There's many different gaps identified, but this $6 billion gap was what's identified for just the state system that we are aware of, and that's what we've programmed a 10-year kind of a plan for. So both in rehabilitation, modernization, and then that strategic expansion, that relates to the state system. Again, that is, even with the state system, there's high priority, high traffic corridors like interstates and U.S. roads, but as part of the governor's proposal, by the formula, CASA formula, roughly $2.4 billion is allocated to counties, municipalities, and local communities. So that's apart from the $6 billion that is actually also funded in the governor's proposal, not all from revenue. It is the revenue plus $2 billion of bonding plus MnDOT efficiencies itself. So, but I refer you back to our slide that actually showed kind of the arithmetic, the green, blue, and orange, and go back. That actually shows where the funds are. There it is. So the $6 billion is the state system. And then $2.35 billion is allocated by formula to a new cash over 10 years for the county and transit system. I have been told by county engineers and mayors that this won't do it, but they know that the largest source of funding for county, city, and townships is property taxes.
So, Mr. Chair, if I just real quickly, Commissioner,
one more.
The $2.4 billion, Commissioner, then is a revenue for that, or at least a portion of the revenue for that. Does that come from the governor's proposal to increase gas taxes on Minnesotans?
Both the percentage of gross receipts and fuel, same place that the gas tax, so that's correct, and the adjustment of the registration fees, and that's in this $8.35 billion blue box. So that's that, it, and then by formula it distributes.
Thank you,
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to applaud MnDOT for the overall budget, but particularly I appreciated your work on the rail grade crossings. And in addition to the accident that you mentioned today, I mean, we had one in West Virginia last week, and I believe it was the USDOT came out with some kind of a study that predicted there'd be 10 of these accidents in the course of a year, $4 billion worth of damage, many fatalities. So I think this is an urgent issue. And you had mentioned, Mr. Zelli, that it's unprecedented, but I think the amount of traffic we're getting is unprecedented. And I guess I'd like, if you could explore a little bit more which I agree with you, the legal grounds that we have for this, because there is an assessment already for track engineers, and so we're already doing this. Now, I know that there's another property tax on railroads proposal, but that's actually, I think, being put forward by the Commissioner of Revenue, and if that proposal be heard, it would probably go to the property tax division. But this one is purely transportation, correct?
Correct.
And do you agree that the assessment part is something we're already doing, and so that wouldn't involve a federal preemption of any kind? Is that the thinking here,
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein? It I think you said it. This is a fee that has been assessed to the railroads this past year, and it helped fund more rail inspectors, which augments the Federal Railway Administration's safety oversight of tracks and hazardous materials and yard inspections. So this is really that same fee. It is increased, but it is there to make the capital improvements that we have assessed have been caused by this increased rail traffic, but also increased safety risks. And again, that the risk is not just to trunk highway motorists or local motorists, it's to the entire communities and cities. And I think that the other property tax adjustment is outside of MnDOT or transportation, but it relates to bringing the assessment of property values in line with how other states have been assessing their property taxes on railroads. So in a way, it's more a part of a general fund property tax policy.
Okay. Representative Petersburg. Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, just real quick, Mr. Chair, thank you. And I appreciate that. A bipartisan group of us has introduced a bill specifically on the rail piece. So hopefully we'll be having an opportunity to talk about that further. And, my thought on this, Mr. Chair, is that, the railroad companies are benefiting. They're making a lot of money. And, but our communities are really absorbing the risk. And so rather than have the taxpayers, pay for this entirely, I'd like to see us do some cost sharing, you know, with the railroads so that, you know, they're profitable. I think they can afford this. The taxpayer should not be subsidizing, you know, the railroad companies for this particular safety improvement. So that's the thinking behind this.
Thank you. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner, thank you again for spending the hour or so with us today. That was the question that I was going to be asking, was in regards to the rail crossing. It looks like the actual 10-year program is going to be about $32.5 million. Are you planning on, I mean, are you set to do this in 10-year increments or yearly increments at about $32 million a year, or do you have an anticipation of doing more one year or the other, or is this really kind of a graduation of involvement?
Commissioner Zelli.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative, I think that's our best thinking. It would really kind of almost a 10-year time horizon. We think we could accelerate some faster, and we would try to do that. There are three high-profile crossings that we know of that have been studied that are more, I hate to say the word shovel-ready, but they're as close to it as you can get, and we know that we'd want to embark on work on those as quickly as possible. We clearly do work in association with the railroads themselves. I mean, they actually do quite a bit of this construction. Whatever the grade crossing is, they're very much, have always been part of that conversation. So having the capacity and the timing, not just the funding capacity, but the construction capacity and timing to do them does take time. But we know that there are some crossings that have been talked about and studied and have been kind of queued up, and frankly, to the railroad's benefit as well. I mean, they're certainly not opposed to any of these projects, and actually, in one case in Willmar, would really streamline a lot of their operations. So this isn't entirely, the projects themselves aren't necessarily being imposed on the railroad. This funding is something that they're likely not to support, but we'll see.
If I could follow up with that, you know, I think that they would love to have better crossings. I'm not sure if they're willing to pay for it. So I think the $32 million and whether or not we can assist that, I'm sure will be played out in probably into the courts rather than what we want. But the question that I would ask, oftentimes when we do impose taxes upon entities, agencies, other groups, and so forth, we generally tie that into at least a perceived benefit to that particular group as well. Since these are actually transportation roads that are put in by the department and by the cities and so forth across their lines that were in existence prior to it, how do you perceive really the benefit to the railroad for us improving our own roads going across them?
Mr. Zelli.
Mr. Chair, I think that is both a practical and a great philosophical question, but which I can't totally speak to with total thoroughness. But I will say that the benefits to the railroads to have clear right-of-ways is something that they're really seeking, both because of the safety risks and liability that is imposed on them with having the highways and communities. Not just a goodwill, but actual operating efficiencies for their part. Now, in much to the railroad's defense and appreciation, they're investing a significant amount of capital in the billions of dollars to their system. And so I think it has to be very much complementary and thought through that for them to not have the sidings to enable to actually park a mile-long train, because blocking roads is something they cannot do. So actually having grade separations gives them more flexibility in terms of they don't have to kind of have that worry and that disruption. So I think there are benefits, and I could probably be more specific if I kind of we study it more, but I think generally there are, it isn't quite, one versus the other. It is both.
Okay. I have one follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, and I appreciate that. And I think the fact that the governor's proposal is setting aside $32 million from this collections for that kind of indicates that we probably would be doing it in $32 million segments, or at least whatever the budget can handle. So I appreciate that. Just a brief follow-up question happens to do with the following slide, which is slide 22, in which you said we need to increase the appropriation of federal funds. I didn't know we could appropriate federal funds. Can we? I mean, I'd love to do that. Or is this really an indication of what we needed to set aside in order to get the federal fund appropriation?
Well,
Mr. Zilli.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I am not the legislative expert, but it's not appropriating federal funds that hasn't already been appropriated and allocated to us. So,
darn.
So you know, believe me, if we could, that's a great idea. But no, I think this is funds that have been appropriated and are available to Minnesota, and we, as Minnesota, have to claim these funds.
I'm going to look to Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I too brought an article, and I don't know if you've seen it, Commissioner. This from the Twin Cities Business Monthly. And it's interesting because the editor challenges some of the claims that are made that our situation is so dire. And he's citing information from Minnesota Management and Budget's State of Minnesota Comprehensive Annual Report. And in that report, a couple things, their assessments found that 95% of our arterial system bridges and 94% of our road system bridges are in fair to good condition. And it's looking at pavement conditions and finds that pavement is improving in both 2012, 2013. I mean, so there's some interesting conflicts of what we're hearing. And I think he raises some good questions. And, I mean, I think we're raising some of the same questions. So just wanted to bring that to your attention.
Well, Ms. Chair and Representative Rumpick, I had not seen that article, and as I maybe stated the last time I was here, there's different ways to measure every asset, and so the more analysis, the better, although we've studied it a lot, and having a roadway or a pavement in good condition in terms of ride quality might be, great for this year. But so we'll actually be at a point where we have less than 9% of our ride quality in poor condition. But if that's a thin overlay and the deterioration of the system underneath is only going to last 2 or 3 years, then we've been looking more comprehensively at service life. When do we expect these roadways to deteriorate? Because having one roadway having a thin overlay, which isn't going to last very long, and if you drive on 394 or 94, you'll see where those spots are. That's very different. So I'm only guessing because I haven't read that article, but I think that the condition of the assets and the road bridge condition are what they are, and we shouldn't be arguing if the data supports the facts.
Well, Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up then. I mean, this editor goes on to ask, are we laying down the best, longest-lasting material, or are we repaving more cheaply than we need to and replacing these roads more frequently than we need to? And he was citing Crosstown 62 in Edina, but, I don't know the circumstances, and might have been a stimulus money situation. Did we get into some of those where we replaced pavement because, we had the money all of a sudden, and we had to use it?
Chair, I defer to Representative Earhart. No, I would say that when we look at our asset management models, that's really could kind of show you and tells us what the right time is to refurbish a road or repave a road versus to totally reconstruct a road. And I think that states have been inefficient. We have ourselves in letting roads go too far and putting a thin patch as opposed to a more comprehensive fix. But, that's in part why, in some cases, we've let roads deteriorate because it's beyond refurbishment. We have to completely reconstruct those roads. And then there's... but I don't think... I'd have to look at the detail of what it is that they're describing.
Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner, I'm going to give you an opportunity, I guess, to clarify some things for me, because the governor's been out across the state suggesting, and he had a list of 600 projects. He's talked specifically quite a bit about Highway 14 and insinuated that without this funding, this new funding, that those projects aren't going to get done. Now, the STIP program that we have, or the STIP plan that we have, right now, if we do nothing else in base funding, we will spend $6.3 billion in transportation over the next 4 years. Are none of those 600 projects in the queue to get done? Is there, will there be no more work on Highway 14 if we don't do the governor's proposal on funding?
Oh, Mr. Chair, it's a great question. And the quick answer is no, they will not be done. The STIP is very clear about the roadways that will be both reconstructed, repaved, and then there are a lot of projects and the roads where the service life is ending within the next 10 years, and then strategic expansion projects like Highway 14, where they're not in the STIP and they're not even in Midship, which is a 20-year outlook, because particularly in areas of expansion where we've had prioritized kind of taking care of the existing system, there's some expansion in the first in this next STIP, but only kind of finishing maybe the Minpass lanes on 35E and a few others. But that's what Corridors of Commerce was actually identifying projects that weren't in our plans because we didn't have funding. And what the reason Highway 14 was highlighted is because it had already been through the vetting of a Corridors of Commerce application and solicitation. And we've done, we've identified projects where we've done some of the engineering, done some right-of-way acquisition, but not enough to actually complete the project. So they're not part of the, many people know this, much to our frustration, are not actually covered through the existing program. And so the idea, I think, the governor's asked is to what to identify, given our models, more than an illustration, what do the models show as roadways and bridges, and then a limited number of expansion projects to kind of show these are areas that are not in the STIP and not in our current funding plan, so it could be identified as illustrating what could be done with additional funding. And that's been a request of the business community and others, is to be more transparent and more explicit about what would the different levels of funding provide. And so this attempt to identify actual roadways and programs is a response to a request to be more transparent, to show, okay, this is, you know, and it could shift. I mean, it could be, you know, weather patterns and others might deteriorate some roads versus others. So it's not a very specific road-by-road commitment, but it's there to show what the models are showing us. Most of that is pavement and bridge refurbishment that's not in the plans. And the few strategic expansions that were highlighted, like Highway 14, were already part of the Corridors of Commerce program. There's additional funding as part of the governor's recommendation for mobility, where the projects haven't been identified. I know roadways in Anoka, which would be very highly priority when you think about some of these applications and some of those funding. And you know, so that, I think that is the idea. So it's less earmarked, quite specifically, not earmarked at all. The governor asked, show us what the models show, to be more explicit. And that's actually the request I made of our planners. And neither the governor nor I said we should have this and not that. I mean, it was more about what do the models show us.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Commissioner, sorry I missed your talk about the airplanes, because that's, again, one of my favorite topics.
Oh.
But looking at this slide that you had here, number 25, about the newer aircraft purchase. Now, I know 5-5 Mike November, and I know 70 Mike November pretty well. I remember when the state acquired 70 Mike November, the avionics package that was even in that airplane at the time, they were sporting a brand new KLN 90B, which was the latest and the greatest for the moving map GPS technology. It's a great airplane. It's a 94. Now, what most people in here probably don't understand is that if everybody in this room were to maintain their car to the standards that you maintain an airplane, you'd have one car in your life. That's how often you replace things. These two airplanes, I'm not really impressed with the fact that somebody puts down here that they're 33 and 21 years old. That's still young for these airplanes. Granted, you have to maintain the engines, and I get all that. But I think I might have a means of saving the state some money instead of going out and buying these slightly used airplanes. It's an avenue that most of these nationally recognized aviation consultants don't usually like to go. It's called military surplus. Places, you know, because the federal government uses King Airs as well as the military. You know, and these airplanes do go up for auction. 10 cents on the dollar. I wouldn't believe that a consultant would given anybody that type of advice. And plus, you know, there's usually when you get in an aircraft sale on two airplanes like that, we're talking even just the commissions on these is a couple $100,000. So what I'd like to see is maybe somebody at the state in the transportation department taking a look at when the next auction is coming up for some of the military and government surplus King Airs are out there, because they are fantastic airplanes. I've got a couple thousand hours flying these King Airs. They go through anything. They last forever. 33-year-old airplane to me is still pretty young, but it just gives you an option instead of just going out and buying, you know, a slightly used airplane. Just a comment.
Mr. Chair, and thank you for those comments. We will certainly explore every avenue, and if it was a bus auction, I'd know what I was talking about. I had no idea. I really defer to some of the experts, and I think our aeronautics division would be happy to, you know, maybe they have taken that under consideration. So I appreciate the comment.
Representative Whelan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for being here again today and your detailed overview. First, I just want to say thank you so much for bringing up roads in Anoka. I appreciate that, and it tells me a lot about you that you listen and you do care about all the folks that come to meet with you, so thank you. My question is about the snow and ice contingency, and I'm just wondering, I'm thinking to myself, rather than having an open appropriation, which makes me kind of nervous, is there a way, or I don't know how it's been done in the past, because we have such varying winters, so one winter is terrible, the next one's great, and et cetera, to have the same appropriation, but just make it so that the fund, you don't draw from it other than for what it's for. And, you know, thinking to myself, people who are in sales, for example, their income goes up and down, but they plan for that, and so this would be a way to plan for that. I don't know if that makes sense, but if you could offer your insight on that, I appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman and I think the idea is to kind of be responsible and not have to be kind of whipsawed. And again, I think the idea is to be able to not have the summer maintenance work suffer from the unpredictability. And I had actually asked, and actually Deputy Commissioner Hatch made a good point, because I was suggesting, why don't we start funding a reserve in the budget, and then it could either fill or we take from it. But as has been pointed out to me, and it's actually a good point, is that why would we have a capital which is undeployed, and it would actually be sitting there? We don't need yet another reserve. So rather than creating another reserve, we have a reserve that's kind of built in. It's the trunk highway fund balance, which is, we always keep at least $100 million reserve there. So we think that that is really an appropriate cushion. We would use it anyway, so rather than coming back almost too late and going through the process of trying to access the reserves, and then we lose that advantage of kind of smoothing it out. So I think the intention was very much as you suggested.
Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Zelli, thank you for being here. I'm just curious your personal thoughts on the big truck bill. You're reaching for more efficiencies. MnDOT says it's not a safety issue, so you must be in favor of my big truck bill.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Zelli.
McNamara, I am been looking at it carefully, and in reviewing the study, which is now 9 years old, that makes some really great points that why aren't we creating more efficiency. But I've actually been aware of some of the big issues associated with truck weights, I think applies to interstates, and I am actually personally concerned that we work with and this might be asking a lot, but we work with the federal government because I think we should have more consistency among all interstates. I know this is a major issue in Duluth. but we have logging trucks going through downtown Duluth. Well, whereas they could have just gone right on to I-35. And I think that there's a lot of complexity to the whole issue. I'm very curious what the report that the Federal Highway is working on, whether they will be able to give any thought and guidance that would help support the more consistency among interstates first and then state roadways. So my personal thinking is that it is a tough call. There's balances either direction. I would like to, and I hate to say study it more, but I would love to see that federal study first and have the interstates maybe be a possibility. So that's just kind of my thought for now.
Representative McNamara.
Commissioner, I certainly respect that, but I think in the short term we should be doing it. It would save millions and millions of dollars for MnDOT that could be put on other projects by reducing the cost. And I hope, I get your idea on wish the feds would deal with the interstate issue, absolutely. And I don't like the idea of pushing trucks from the interstate onto state highways. But we have example after example where the trucks never would be near an interstate and transportation would be saved lots of dollars. So please have an open mind and help us with the governor. It should become law and be part of the solution in May. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair,
thank you.
I hear you.
And members, we've got another committee coming in after this. So, Representative Bernardi, you've promised this is a really good question, so I'm going to give you the last one.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe we could have a follow-up meeting to this if you think it's a really good question. So, thank you for coming, Commissioner. Appreciate your leadership. I'd like you to share with the committee the status of the asset management plan that MnDOT has and how it relates to the MAP 21 federal requirements. And then my follow-up question, I don't think we're going to be able to, you know, get this all answered today. That's why it might be good to come back. But the follow-up one is, how will the implementation of MAP 21 impact the remaining service life of our state and local roads not on the national highway system? I think this is an important matter that our committee might want to take up.
Representative Barney, I do agree with you, and I think if there is information that maybe rather than try and sum that up in 30 seconds, maybe that you could get to the committee, and we'd appreciate that.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Bernardi, you're right. I think that's a bigger issue, and we'd be happy to follow up. MAP 21 does really kind of start rolling out even now recently. The idea of performance measures is being what directs our program, and I think at MnDOT we've been slightly ahead of the game, but it does actually show that performance measures and what the goals are that we're trying to achieve are really critical, and we should have both transparency and help guide us as to what we're doing. So thank you for the question.
So, Mr. Chair, with that follow up being in a committee informal informational hearing, or will it be in written, or how?
Possibly right now. I'm just requesting information from Commissioner Zelli on that. Thank you, Commissioner Zelli and Deputy Commissioner Hatch. We appreciate your time with the committee today. Committee members, we are a change of schedule here. We will not be meeting Monday night. We'll go with our regular meeting on Monday. We've got presentation by counties, cities, and townships, and then we'll hear three additional bills. So we'll not have the meeting Monday night, our regular time Monday. Thank you very much. Meeting's adjourned.
No, thank you.